If you knew you were starting a business that would generate you $1 million per year, how much would you be willing to invest today?
Travis Ferris is a real estate entrepreneur, sales coach, team leader, public speaker, and community builder. He's done the work with over $500 million in total sales. Now he's welcoming you to the table. But make sure you're ready. The coffee is for closers only.
The mindset's the one thing that's going to keep you going.
Coffee for Closers is powered by Collab Agents. Here's your host, Travis Ferris.
Hey, listeners, thank you so much for tuning in to Coffee for Closers, powered by Collab Agents. Today, I've got a special friend, one of my good buddies that I've been friends with for, 14, almost 15 years. Met back in the day when Mr. Michael Libertini was managing at Bank of Hawaii, and I was a broke college kid. He was always one step ahead of me, but just a little bit of background. My good friend here, Michael Libertini, he's just like one of the smartest business dudes I know, has been a friend and mentor again for 14, 15 years, always bounced ideas, talked story, and kind of came up together, even though, again, he was always one or two steps ahead of where we were at. But I'm super happy to have him on the show because of where he, has been around the world, ended up in Hawaii, plugging into Bank of Hawaii, getting into the, Oahu, Hawaii, Kaka'ako development scene and just crushing that market, going into the loan world, where he's now, absolutely an expert in tapping into investment, real estate, flipping. And so we're going to hop right into this thing. Again, Coffee for Closers is about bringing individuals who just exemplify closing deals, making money, growing in the business world or whatever niche. But without further ado, thank you, Mr. Michael Libertini, for plugging in, man. Welcome.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me on the show.
Awesome. Well, I'm currently at Hawaii Mortgage Group currently, but we're going to hop right into just the hook, and then we're going to talk about a bunch of different things, syndicates, your condo to college kind of program that you've been doing. But as far as listeners, I think one of the things that's really trending right now is this flipping concept. You see the seller financing subject to assumptions, acquisition deals. So realistically, how are you making an extra $500,000 a year in real estate investing, flipping, and all of those things, the sweet spot, what you focus on, and run us through that world, man?
Yeah, so I mean, as everyone knows, the real estate investing world has changed quite a bit. So we've actually seen investment bankers and a number of different flippers that have actually exited the market just because with rates where they are, it just doesn't pencil. But I actually see any of the headwinds that we face as real estate investors as actual opportunities. And so when you start to break down kind of what's going on inside the marketplace, you start to get a real sense and feel of going, hey, what's the upside opportunity here? And so I can share with you some successes, some heartaches, some all the in between that kind of landed with me where I'm at today. But I can kind of start by saying, the fix and flip game has been sensationalized by folks like HGTV, right? Everybody loves to see that kind of rags to riches or that broke house to this a beautiful, amazing thing. And, if everybody makes $1 million out of it, that's great. For me, I try to stay away from the marketing side of it because I feel there's some real tactile things that kind of, exemplify it. I let others to market it however they want to. And, agents make great for marketing real estate and things like that. But I actually get into the numbers, right? So I think you've been a huge proponent of do the math. And so you can have a beautiful home that was, absolutely a teardown, comes into it, and it's the most cutting edge, beautiful home that everybody wants, has great curb appeal. But if it's a loser for $100,000, I mean, what did you really do? Right. So I try to get into the math on things and really try to push at it from there. And so with the fix and flip game, we always say it's kind of a cliche thing. You don't make money on the sell, you make money on the buy. Right. So our tagline for what we typically try to do is that we buy off market, we sell off market. Right. So the strategy has always got to be speed. Speed wins. Right. So hard money loans, as a difference from conventional lending, is when hard money loans are traditionally a 12 to 18 month product. So you got to think from acquisition to demo to studs, going up construction, you really want that science down to a 3 to 6 month time frame. You add in a governing body like the Department of Planning and Permitting, DPP, you're already behind the eight ball, right? So you've got to learn to navigate through those things and go, hey, the property that I'm really wanting to do is everything that I'm going to be doing is going to be inside of those four walls. If I'm adding any square footage, making it a second unit, that permit requirement is going to push your project 12 to 18 months easily, right? And there's nothing worse than having a completely done project and it sit there because you can't close the permits and you can't get conventional financing onto it. So the traditional trajectory that we like to go to is that once we identify a potential property and we go after it, we like to find a potential buyer at the same time. Right. So we're thinking about a pool of buyers that are interested in buying something off market. They're, you know, looking to have maybe a little bit more control on maybe color palettes or different types of finish work that you can put into the property. And so we, as soon as the acquisition, so as soon as we land into escrow, you know, we may ask for a 30, 45 day close, but we are actively trying to sell that thing before it ever even closes on our end. So we have a buyer lined up, we negotiate a price, and you know, with a lending background, we're able to kind of look at maybe some figures and be able to help maybe even subsidize those figures with facilitating something like a called a 2-1 buy down, right? Where you're able to alleviate some of the sticker shock by providing an upfront subsidy on the payment. And so that, those are a lot of the strategies that we employ at what we do, but that's on the fix and flip side. And I would say that, you know, realistic expectations for a fix and flip in Hawaii, you know, the sweet spot is going to be right about that $1 to $1.3 million ARV. And what I mean by that is called after rehab value, right? So even with rates where they are, you know, you're pushing people to the max right about 1.3. So if you have two abled working individuals, what you call them professionals or not, you know, if their combined income's around $200,000 a year, you know, given with all the expenses of cars, schools, all that kind of stuff, you know, their payment is really going to be maxed out at between $6,000 and $7,000 a month. You know, that's going to give them about $1 million mortgage. With taxes and insurance, maybe a couple hundred thousand dollars down for a down payment. But that's where we're going to see everyone kind of maxed out at. And so if you're buying there, again, you make money on the buy, you got to think, if I'm going to put $200,000 in this thing, I've got carry costs, I've got, you know, any you know, kind of contingency fees or anything like that. You know, you really want to be buying these things at below $800,000 for you to make any money. And so if, you know, you're seeing a rough teardown that they're wanting 900, 925, and, you know, you put them the bare minimum to get it to about $1,050,000, maybe 1.1, that's really not the the home runs that you're going to be hitting. And so to keep yourself safe, we stay disciplined at what we call 70% of ARV. So your total debt on any one project or another should be 70%. Of an ARV. So if the ARV is $1 million, you want your all-in cost to be at 700 grand, right? So if you're still paying agents to be able to market and sell your listing, let's just add 5% in there for sales commission fees. You add another percent for closing costs. I mean, you're at 6% already. You're evaporating that profitability on the get-go. So to be able to make $200,000 to pay off any investors that you have participating in the deal, that's really where the numbers kind of flash out. Now, where you might be able to kind of mitigate some of those things is that if you are a great individual raising capital, so let's just say you have a hui of five different investors or five past clients that you've worked with, you've helped them grow their home equity exponentially over the course of the last 5 years. Everybody wants to put in 200 grand. Well, shoot, you don't need a hard money loan, right? You can go into it and buy it all cash, self-fund it on the construction side of it, and then flip. So you might save yourself 75 to 100 grand right there. in being able to sell funds. So there's different opportunities out there for a lot of different people, but the fix and flip game, you're just to be frank, I mean, in the Hawaii market, you have a legit 20 different flippers on Oahu that know what they're doing. And so if you put your line in the same fish pond as them, you better align yourself with someone who knows what they're doing, because you're going to show up to the iPhone fight with a pager. And that's the last thing that you want to do. So I can speak probably another 2 hours if you really wanted to on fix and flips. But I think they're a small subset of the market because it is changing. I'm going to switch gears and talk a little bit about condotels unless you have any questions for me.
Yeah, and I'm going to come back around just for 2 seconds as far as just the reality of this, because as an agent, again, I've bought and sold numerous primary residents trying to get into some investment properties. But again, you, I think you nailed it on the head that this entire world is super glamorized on it. And I've helped investors in my 15-year career doing exactly what you're doing. And I watch these investors and you can see actually who's going to make it, who's not, who's doing good. I can see a bad flip. You know, when you see that flip come on the market, you know, there's a lot we could go into this, but bigger's not always better. The profit margins are so sharp. And this is where, you know, to talk about it in reality, if you're listening to this and or watching, you know, when the market's skyrocketing up, yeah, you can get a listing, throw floor and paint on it and be like, I'm a seasoned professional. Okay, well, where things get dicey is where the market flatlines or, you know, has its ups and downs. All right, well, that's where, as everyone says it, you know, when the tide goes out, you can see who's wearing swim trunks or not. It's the margin spread. You know what I mean? Like one misstep, you take it, it's going to crush you. And not only are you not making money, but you're losing money. You're trying to hemorrhage. The one thing that is really interesting that you've talked about as well that I learned is, again, like a simple, like using agents is going to interrupt the spread, the profit margin by, you know, we'll say 3 to 5% roughly off the top. Well, hard money lenders, and this is one thing that I didn't, you always talk about speed, like, you know, speed to market, speed to get it sold. You know, if you take a hard money loan and didn't syndicate the deal with a HUI, like you were talking about, which is a collective of investors, you know, getting it sold in 30 days, you're profiting and making money. Well, the second that you hit 60 days or beyond, the different interest rates from the hard money lenders kind of kick in. So that was one of the interesting things talking with you in the past. Is that, hey, I had a hard money loan and it was structured like this. It didn't go as quick as we wanted, but then there was different, like, you know, cascading rates essentially based on how long it took. Is that right?
Yeah. So when you have a hard money loan, I mean, their objective is to get paid back as quickly as possible. So if you take a look at conventional rates, you know, we're hovering right around the mid sixes right now. Any of the hard money loans right now for fix and flip, even with, and it, by the way, it's not what you think. It's not like, oh, I have a great credit score, therefore I get a lower interest rate. They actually care very little about that. As long as you have, if you're not defaulted on anything, they'll give you a loan at a preferred rate. They care about how many deals that you've done in the last 3 years. They care about if you're profitable, and they care about the collateral in terms of the upside on the ARV. So if you have the cash down, they're not going to look at you like, oh, we're going to give you a preferred rate. They're just going to be like, hey, we're not going to impose default rates against you on this, this, and this. So I'll give you a scenario. Let's just say you start a hard money loan. You're going to, you know, put 20% down on the property. So you're buying $1 million property, put 20% down, you're lending $800,000. Well, you're going to need $200,000 to really renovate the property correctly. So they're going to give you an additional $200,000 in construction costs. But those construction costs, they're not, hey, here's $200,000, go hog wild. They actually have a service where they'll put an inspector out there to ensure that the completion of the project is going on schedule before they release the funds to you. So your contractor is just as important as your lender in that they've got to be able to perform and perform under the guidance of an inspector before you recover some of those funds back. right? So let's just say, you know, they go demo. Demo's not expensive, right? But let's say they have to put up drywall. They've got to redo the plumbing and electrical. Well, it's got to pass a Board of Water Supply inspection. It's got to pass maybe an electrical code inspection. And then the lender is going to go, hey, I want this inspected and I want these things written that it's been to completion. Now we'll give you the funds that you need to. Well, let's just say everything's going according to plan. 6 months, you're done, right? You're like, hey, we listed it. We put it on the market. $1.5 million in the back of Kalihi. It's going to sell, make millions, right? Well, it sits because you have a 3-2 in the back of Kalihi next door to the Chicken Fighters, and there it's not moving at 1-5, right? So then you're going, oh, shoot, what am I going to do? Well, you start talking to the hard money lender and they're going, well, you have two options. You can either pay it off or you can go into default. And when you go into default, you have maybe a 3-month timeline to get an extension, which costs a minimum of 10 grand. Plus they jack your interest rate from say 11% to like 13. So you, like you were talking about, without that speed, all of a sudden your projections on where you were going to sell start going exponentially into the red. And so what you have to do as an investor is plan for that. You know, a lot of times CEOs and, you know, a lot of visionary people, they operate in the ether, right? They don't really have any bankers to talk them down off of that merry-go-round that they think that they're on. And then they fall into their own, you know, trap. So I think you need to have some, you know, I'm not going to say a doomsdayer, but, you know, bankers are about as pretty close to doomsday as you. They crush dreams because they're going, hey, here's the reality of it. So one of the things I think we go through in the real estate process, just as a mortgage broker in general, is we take the hat off of buyer. So a buyer hat, fun, right? New smells, new houses. I'm going to look at stuff. Everything's beautiful. You take that hat off and you put on the hat of the owner, okay? The owner is the one that has to pay for the roof. The owner is the one that found foundational issues where you're going to have to, you know, dig up some stuff and, you know, reset. Those are the questions and conversations that I think aren't had inside of the sensational fix and flip type of deals, right? So if you can, find a group of people that have pretty much all three, right? They have the upside dreamers. You have the realists that that operate into the everyday, and then you have the doomsdayers that go into that, right? So between those three, somewhere lies the truth, and it's up to you to kind of figure out what that is. But I can say from the current market, the more conservative you can be on the buy and acquisition, the better and more dreamlike the sale will be.
Boom. There you go. Okay. Well, cool, man. At the end here, we'll get contact info if people want to find you. And you know, I know that there's like formulas and calculations, and I'm sure people could reach out with a lot of those fun things. Let's move right on to like condo for college kind of concept that you were tinkering around with.
Yeah, so this is a different strategy than fix and flip, right? So this was actually a means to an end, and it has a very altruistic notion to me. You know, we grew up in the era where we were, you know, fed this line that college was the be all end all to become somebody, right? My mom was indoctrinated inside of that, tried to impose that upon me. And I think going through the steps, right, as a young, impressionable young man, I was trying to believe the Kool-Aid too, but that's not what I actually figured out. I actually figured out that these institutions of quote unquote higher education were businesses just like anybody else. They were selling their wares, and not really, it was inconsequential to them whether you did well or not. It was actually just going, hey, buy our stuff. I hope you do well, but they really weren't invested inside of your future or what success that was going to bring to you. So in thinking about that, you know, I tried to reverse engineer, like, what did college really do for me? Well, college gave me a network of people that were kind of like-minded, gave me a 4-year drinking party that I really enjoyed. But it also taught me how to think, right? So I will give it that. It forced you like, all right, I've got a week to cram for a biochemistry final exam. How am I going to partition this to be able to cram as much knowledge as I can to at least get a C, right? And I think that discussion is a lot of what I do inside of real estate investing, I have a fixed amount of time to be able to solve a problem, and I got to be smarter than five other guys. How do I do that, right? So that's what college meant to me. And then after becoming a father, I was going, do I really want to scrimp and save and kill myself on a 529 program to be able to save for my daughter to go through the same thing, which, let's be honest, post-COVID, they can get online, right? Like, so there's really no tangible benefit for me to be able to, like, got a semi. Now, there's a caveat here, okay? There's the name brands out there. Hey, if you're going to Harvard, Stanford, you know, Yale or something like that, the network alone may have the intrinsic value to be able to say, hey, there's an upside onto this on the investment. But if you're going to a state school anywhere in the United States, I think that the ROI is fairly low. Now, people may chastise me for saying something like that because there are a lot of people that, you know, may feel otherwise, and I respect your opinions. But for someone like me, I think I could learn just as much in the trenches actually doing business than learning theoretical stuff about how the business is supposed to be done. So in taking that, I try to come up with an idea called Condo to College. And it's a borrowed concept. So, you know, many of my friends that were going to college whose parents were well-to-do, what they did is they bought their kid a condo, right? As soon as they started school, they could live in it. They would ultimately realize the appreciation benefits. Their, you know, six buddies who were living in it with them were helped subsidizing the cost of the mortgage. And then they would simply sell the thing right after they graduated and pay for at least half of the tuition bill, right? So I was like, oh, this is brilliant, right? This is actual stuff that's happening. How can I kind of borrow that and make it my own? Well, so what I did as soon as my daughter was born is I bought a condo, right? And so I bought a small little condo, 200 grand over in back near Don Quixote, and I rented out, right? And my job as a father, as a parent, is to make sure that that condo is paid off when my daughter goes to school. So I have 18 years to do it. Now, the premise of this is going, hey, through the whole thing, the house needs to be painted. I take my daughter to go do it. Here we're doing monthly bills and figuring out how the rent's going in, what are the maintenance fees. My daughter sits down with me and goes to the bank to make the deposits, right? She's going to learn all of these steps that at the end, and she has no idea this is going to happen, but when she wants to go to college, I'm like, here, sweetie, here's a completely paid for condo. So let's just say it's worth $300,000. I hope that it's going to cover as much or as much as the tuition can be for you. And you have a choice. You can live in it rent free, right? You own it. You can rent it out and get monthly income to be able to help subsidize your lifestyle. You could sell the thing and put all of it down on red, or go to college and be able to pay your tuition just fine. But the point is you're going to say, hey, Dad, you didn't pay for my college. Somebody else did, right? And I think at the genesis of how I operate and how I do, I'm trying to figure out ways to be able to have other people subsidize my lifestyle. And Condo to College was kind of the birthplace of that. And so I've been really promoting and teaching this, not only on my social channels, but also to, you know, parents that are inquisitive and going, how does this work? What are my responsibilities? How do I lower the barriers of entry to be able to do this? And so I think in my heart of hearts, even if I made no money ever on this venture, I would love to just to be able to plant that seed that there was other ways to be able to save your kids' education and not have to kill yourself during the day-to-day to be able to do it.
Boom. Yeah, 100%. I think super invaluable in terms of learning, maximizing, and just gaining that capital to, because that's the thing too. It's like, you know, I think we all have well-to-do friends, right? And, you know, some of the concept is I want to spoil the hell out of my kids as well and give them, hey, what do you want? Like, again, it's like, how do I buy my daughter a G-Wagon without making a little, you know, turd, if you will. And so I think that you have to have these benchmarks in place, kind of like if you look at, I can't remember who it was, Warren Buffett or some of the greats, that like one of them that I liked is that they would only gift their kids as much as they've earned. So, okay, you know, if you've made like 500K, I will give you 500K. Like, they will only give them as much money as they've earned, so that you're not robbing. Because I think I always talk to people, or and especially Nisa, in terms of like, if somebody gave me 10 mil, you'd be like, okay, like, it's almost the concept of, you know, the 100 million a year business versus the 100,000 a year business. And if you swap the owners, the 100,000 a year business is going to run down the 100 million a year business, and the 100 millionaire business is going to run up the 100,000. And it's the same concept, just psychologically, the psychology of money is about creating these benchmarks and milestones of, how do I give them everything without robbing them of all the things that they need to know in life. So I think that's a great concept.
I think you segue perfectly into kind of what me and my wife have subscribed to. And this was a lesson taught to me actually by my mom. And it was taught to me by necessity, not necessarily by virtue. But the concept is that whatever your kids want, whatever they want, I never tell them no. Never tell them. I go, this is what you got to do to get a yes. And similar to the whole, I'll gift you only what you've earned, is going, hey, what do you want? Hey, I want an Xbox, a new Xbox. How much is it? $600. You're in the three, I'll get you the other three. And you kind of define really early on a need versus a want. And so what happens in the psychology of the child is they're going, shoot, he didn't tell me no. He said, yes, I could get it, right? Which is an affirmation with the parent. But then there's also something on the hook for me. And so rather than having possessions now that you love, that were gifted to you, you get to say, I earned part of that. And there's a different stewardship that happens over property that's earned versus property that's given. And so you can see it evident to children all the time when they're given a Barbie or a toy or anything like that. They just throw it on the ground. They don't care, right? But when kids have gone, hey, I earned this, not only do they take pride in showing other family members that, hey, I earned part of this, they also take care of it a hell of a lot better too. And so I think I'm trying to demonstrate and model behavior like stewardship of property and things, but also just making sure you can identify a need versus a want. We all want things, right? But what do we need? What's important? And then for those wants, like a G-Wagon, how do I get it? Those are the breadcrumb trails that I think we got to teach.
Yeah, for sure. And again, dude, I've always loved talking story with you, because I mean, I have made every mistake. I've hit every wall in the building at least twice.
I will say that despite you hitting every wall twice, I've never seen you not run through the wall. So I will give you credit there, that even if you wanted to revisit that chapter, you still ran through the wall.
Yeah, totally. So that's the show, man. And actually, I was on a podcast in Scottsdale last week, which should be coming out in the next couple weeks. And that's the one that, as far as my goal for like podcasting, is like, we're going for it. I mean, I know you're going for it. You've done some awesome things. Like, I am going for it. I'm not going to give up. But throughout this process is like the inspiration that I hope to like give people is like this, because like I have suffered, and we're going to talk about this here in a second, as I want to loop back around, hear your story, where you're from, where you've been around the world, how you ended up where you're at. But it's like, you know, and where the market is, you know, and after we get that and find out where we're today to say, okay, where has the market been? It's like, you know, I have suffered throughout the hitting every wall that we talk about. And you just, as a leader, because again, like one of my favorite quotes is, you know, I am a leader. You know, you're not a leader because people follow you, you're a leader of self, and people following you is a result of your leadership of yourself. You know, same thing with you. You wake up at 5 a.m., you work out. No one's watching you, but when you lead yourself effectively, eventually people might see how you lead yourself and want to follow you. It's the fact is, as a leader, you feel really alone and you feel like you're the only person going through like this suffering. So that's what I was saying in this last podcast is like, I just want people, I want to hear where successful people have suffered or are suffering and what they did to get through it. I want people listening here to like hear how I have suffered, how I'm suffering, and how I got through it. Cause it's like the ups and downs in life, like the hardest years of my life have been the best. And like, this is the concept of God. And you talk about stewardship. It's like, you know, I think the reason why I ran into every wall at least once is because I was building my empire. And then when I realized how am I a steward of building God's empire, I ran into every wall again. But it's just, it's a, like, it's a suffering, like life is. And I was just talking to Nisa about this last night, to where, like, I can't remember which Greek mythology of the dude who had to push the boulder up the hill for eternity.
Oh, Atlas.
Was that Atlas that had to put, like, oh, that roll, had to roll the boulder
on his back and stuff like that? I can't remember.
No, so Atlas had to hold the world on his shoulders, but there was another Greek mythology where he literally had to push a rock boulder up a mountain for all eternity. And I was like, thinking about it.
Yeah, probably a little fuzzy.
I'll look it up. Let's see. But that is, like, that can be, like, you know, a metaphor for life. Like, life just has burdens. It has suffering that comes with it. And obviously there's massive gifts along the process. But that, I guess that's the hopes, is that people listening are like, dude, I'm going through that, or I went through that myself. Because even at a group we were at yesterday with some, like, high producers, like super high producers, I was talking about, like, leadership and our team and some betrayals. And he literally was like, can I see a raise of hand? Is who else in this room has faced these betrayals? And everyone raised their hand. And he's like, anyone not raise their hands lying. And it was just like, it's like, okay, like, these people who have gotten there have gone through what we've gone through. So that's the long story short. I'm going to look up. We want to hear the 4-minute story. Where are you from? Where did you end up, while I'm looking up this Greek creature?
Yeah. So kind of from what you just mentioned in Scottsdale and, you know, different things. I would claim that I'm from Arizona. I grew up in Los Angeles, went out to Arizona during the LA riots time just to escape, you know, inner city turmoil. Got involved in just, you know, doing sports and, you know, trying to stay out of trouble. But ultimately started traveling. So as soon as I got to college, I figured out that, you know, the college scene wasn't really for me. I played football in college, but yeah, I was somewhat disenfranchised by the promises that it was trying to dish out to me. I ended up finishing school, but it wasn't a priority. I actually wanted to get on the road and start figuring out, you know, who I was. And so took a leap of faith and actually went to Alaska. And took 4 months over in Alaska. I know it's a place near and dear to your heart. But, you know, kind of found a sense of purpose on the Kenai River, and just go, you know, there's a serenity in nature that I found and was connected to. And I said, you know, there's so many beautiful places in this world. I want to go see them all before, you know, I get, you know, tied down with kids and everything like that. So lived in Australia, went to about 35 different countries. Just really wanted to figure out, you know, like, what the travel scene was about. And I probably got, you know, a bachelor's degree in that, learning about different cultures and tolerance and language and everything else in between. But ended up coming to Hawaii on a free trip with a girl that I was with, thought it was bad floral print and ukulele music, and ultimately came here. And, you know, as you can tell, I kind of badge myself as a culturally ambiguous person. And or what we like to call in Hawaii is chop suey. And, you know, I found a team of people here that were just like me, had Asian influence, you know, Hispanic influence, and every influence in between. And the perpetual summer and just beautiful sunshine, clean air, I haven't left. And so as I sit on my lanai now, absolutely infatuated with the place. I had a very smart mentor of mine once said, hey, Michael, go find out where your tribe is, where you belong, and everything else will kind of fall into place. And so I kind of did that, got into the finance scene. I think I had a background, you know, in business, really wanted to understand how money worked. And I was like, who has the most money that I can think of? A bank, let's go work for there. So applied at a bank. They said, you don't have any experience, son, come back to us when you have some experience. Went in there for 37 business days straight, asking the manager to hire me, finally did. And so that persistence paid off. And then kind of the rest is history. Became a regional manager for a bank, figured out the kind of corporate world that, you know, I'm more entrepreneurial than I am, you know, political. And so started doing my own thing, which, you know, loans and real estate industry gave me the platform for. And now it's kind of branched off into its own, you know, side hustles are making just as much as the main job is. And that's the hope, is to make money while you sleep, and, you know, to hopefully be able to retire in a financially independent place, to where all the things that you've learned along the way, you put into practical application, and now you're singing and laughing. So I don't know if that was 4 minutes, but that was the best I could do.
Yeah, no, you're perfect. And that, again, that was the quick version of it. Again, I've been talking to Mike here from when he was first hired and tapped to kind of launch actually one of the bank's new branches. That's where we kind of had met and became friends there. But again, I was just always impressed with network plugged into the Kakaako, which again, like money, like it's the concept of money and where's the money at? And, you know, even Kakaako, like if you're familiar with Oahu or not, Oahu is the metropolis island. They were talking about, you know, for the last 40 years going west, which they did. They definitely did. But, you know, instead of going west immediately, they went up and crowded in Honolulu. And that was the area of Kakaako. When I first moved to Hawaii in like 2006, that was like the warehouse district. Like it was like warehouse industrial. And then there was massive plans for, you know, probably 10 to 20 years to completely redevelop that. And, you know, you were basically in on the ground floor of that development plugging in. So I was always impressed with how you networked through that opportunity and plugging into the developers and kind of working around there. So that was always awesome. So real quick, Sisyphus. For his offenses to both Zeus and Hades, Sisyphus was condemned to eternal punishment in Tartarus, the lowest region of the underworld. The king of Corinth would forever roll a massive boulder to the top of a steep hill, but his efforts were always in vain, for whenever Sisyphus neared the top, the rock would roll right back down again. And he was thus forced to start his labor all over again for eternity. Again, it sounds terrible, but it's just, you know, Nisa and I were talking about just the one step at a time. Like there's times in life where you're going to be like facing this massive burden. And the only way to get through it is one step at a time. And actually this is, I don't know if it's familiar with you, Mike, or listeners, like when I look back at some of the most like adverse years I've had, just of just left and right crap hitting the fan, were also subsequently some of the best years. We're like, well, hey, that year was actually one of the best years. All right, let's loop around here because we kind of found out where you came in, where you plugged in at. I mean, for me personally, again, we had baby number two. The real estate market with interest rates went absolutely gangbusters. We still closed out $44 million in 2023 by like the skin of my teeth, and I feel like a de-feathered chicken. But like, where were you at? How did you shift? How did you pivot? How did you get through that? How are you diversifying, you know, around those things? And like, where are you at now?
All right. So great segue. So I had left the bank to go pursue a marketing agency. So I was COO of a marketing agency that brought one of the Kakaako condos on board. So we went from soup to nuts. So we went from land acquisition to what are the namesakes going to be, what are the types of units this is going to be, what are the price points, what are the design elements. And we were jamming, right? So Victoria Place is the project that we brought online. And, you know, we had everything from strategy with agents to strategy to Japan. We built a sales office out there. We did a number of different things to try to sell this thing out and do it in the fastest way possible. Well, that was 2019. So you can guess what happened in March of 2020 is that we actually had sold 55% of the building out within its first week of being brought onto the line. And so we did that through a number of different strategies that I won't bore you with now. But then that was in February of 2020. And so immediately following that, we jump into COVID and we're on lockdown, right? Like there is no in-person, the sales offices we built that were millions of dollars are empty, right? And so we had to deploy quickly and pivot to a digital strategy, which didn't require a whole lot of people, right? And so we had to figure out pretty quickly where we were headed. And so the company that I was with, we negotiated for a number of different weeks in the coming times. And we felt, you know, like I felt like I was cliffhanger, right? And it was kind of like I was the heavy guy at the bottom of the line. And I was like, I gotta cut, or else all you guys are gonna die. So I cut myself off. So I fired myself, which was an interesting deal. Fortunately, you know, like I was able financially to be able to weather that storm. But then jumped right back into lending when interest rates went from, you know, 4.5 to 2.5, right? And so started really doing the heavy lifting inside of that lending space from 2020 to 2022. And we had a great party, had a wonderful party. And then all of a sudden, interest rates start jacking up. I mean, you can't print 40% of our currency and not expect to be have some sort of ramifications for that. So party was over, great party, hangover's worse, right? So the hangover is still persisting as we are today. I just did an interest rate update on another recording, and you know, just like, when is rate relief coming? Well, you know, between Jamie Dimon and you know Jerome Powell, we're not seeing until midsummer, right? Where, and interest rate relief, by the way, is not going to be 4%. Interest rate relief is going to be 5.5%. And so, you know, people got to understand that this is the new normal. Historically, still being lower than what we've seen. We didn't get into the teens or anything like that on the interest rates, but we haven't also seen the corrections, right? So with supply and demand issue, especially here in Hawaii, if you have 3% mortgage, and even if you have $400,000 of equity, what am I going to go buy? And am I going to swap that 3% mortgage for a 7%? Doesn't make sense, right? So as we go through, we still feel that, you know, I talked earlier about doomsdayers, right? And I'm not a doomsdayer by any stretch of the imagination, but I probably fall in the middle. People have been accustomed to living off the refi, right? So all of this consumer spending that you're still seeing in the marketplace, CPI is up, job numbers are great, where, you know, we're still seeing a lot of spending. That's not in cash, guys. That's off of their equity of their homes. So sooner or later, there's going to be a pressure cooker that does force a reaction. So I'm starting to see the first wave of refinances coming through this year. And by virtue of, you know, hey, I spent too much during, you know, my COVID times and I got to start earning. I put the kids' tuition onto it. And, you know, I took trips that I probably shouldn't have, and they're going to have to figure that out. But as we navigate forward in the new interest rate environment, the way that I look at it is going, hey, this gave us a lot of time to incubate ideas like condo to college, fix and flip strategies. We talked about the condo in itself is that, hey, I've probably exited 4 or 5 different condo projects while, you know, 3 years in the construction process, profited $100,000 off of each one, right? Just because you're in the right place, right time, and the market continues to soar. So there's a lot of tactile things that I think you need to be aware of and jump on. Advice always, and you know, this is just purely my advice, don't ever get into something you don't understand. So if you're blindly giving your money away to somebody and hoping that it's going to double, that's a terrible strategy, right? So look underneath the hood, do something that you know that you're familiar with. And I can't tell you how many agents I interact with on a regular basis that sell this stuff that don't apply these same strategies to their own financial situation. And so if you are selling it, if you are believing in it, actually be a practitioner, right? Go do some of this stuff. And I realize Hawaii is a tough place to do it. You don't have to do it in Hawaii. One of my first flips I did was in Vegas. It was a $125,000 deal. I mean, I know that, you know, you having multiple different locations, both on the mainland and over here in Hawaii, you can identify a ton of different marketplaces that have upside potential into there. So go into it both eyes open. Make sure that the risk tolerance is something that falls squarely in your ethos, but also just realize that, hey, there's going to be challenges. There's going to be betrayals. There's going to be all these things that kind of happen inside of that. That probably is part of it. But you're learning as you learn along the way, you know, 5, 8, 10 years into it. Now I can pull the levers and really start to hit my stride in terms of profitability. And I think you and I had a sidebar conversation of just the differentiation for being king of my domain versus going, hey, I can let things organically have some inertia behind it. I don't have to be front and center stage, and I can still make a healthy living on it. And so I think sometimes getting wealthy isn't sexy, right? I'm a get rich slow guy. And a lot of times, you know, it's just making that $400 or $500 extra a month, right? I'm managing a couple of properties that yield me a 10% over rent return. Why do I do it? Because it's easy, and I just keep on adding. Hey, it's an extra $1,000 to my monthly outgo. It's an extra this, right? But all those side hustles, they all add up to where your residuals. Let's just say I lose my job, or you know, it dries up again. I'm still getting $7,000, $8,000, $10,000 a month in residual lines of business that I've kind of have the plates spinning in the air, and I'm not as stressed. I'm not as worried, right? So in business, we often call this a key man insurance policy. What that means is that if you have a business that is predicated off of one man's relationship, typically you have to provide an insurance policy. If that guy, if something were to happen to that guy or gal, what are you gonna do, right? And so that's how we operate our family household, is that there can be no one key man person. We actually have to diversify those income streams to hedge against anything happening to a key man person. So I think that's my kind of philosophy, where I pivoted, what I'm doing, and how I'm trying to make sense of where the marketplace is today.
Cool, man. Yeah, again, we'll definitely have a follow-up episode and dive into some other things. I guess in the last 10 years or so, 10 or 15 years, whatever it is, from, you know, being around the world and in Alaska and starting at the bottom at some places, like what would be like your biggest failure, your most painful moment that you like, you know, that moment of suffering to where you're like got through it? Like what is the hardest moment in the last 10 or 15 years that you made it through it to be where you're at now?
Referencing back to what I mentioned just recently is that, you know, I did have to fire myself, right? And I was in a place to where the uncertainty started to get to me, right? It's going, what am I going to do? And, you know, like, how can I reinvent myself? And, you know, for me, it's, I hate to say this because as a realist, I play both sides of the ball, offense and defense. But what I find most in those times of uncertainty is that you've got to get on offense. Defense typically brings in those thoughts of doubt, right? And offense really forces you to continually do activity. So when I say that is, you know, I have football analogies all the time, but throw the rock, right? Yeah, you know what? You're going to throw a pick. You're going to throw a bad pass. You're going to do some things you wish you didn't. But at least it's activity you can measure and have a discussion about. If you're playing defense the entire time, you're just worried about what the other person's gonna do. And so what it forced me to do, and you know, we talk about the suffering, is that, you know, for me, I don't necessarily see myself pushing the rock up the hill, but I definitely liken myself to a CrossFit movement called a burpee, right? And that's basically you fall down and you get back up, right? And so that whole embodiment for me was going, I just got to get up more times than I fall down, right? And so when I do CrossFit workouts pretty regularly, you know, burpees are one of my favorite exercises just because of the symbolism that I've associated with it. And it's going, hey, I'm going to trip and I'm going to fall. I'm going to land on my face. This isn't comfortable. My heart rate's elevated, but I just got to get up, right? And so I think that's the offensive side for me, is that during those times of uncertainty, not only focusing in on things like health and fitness, things that matter, spending quality time with family, but being on offense. Hey, what did you do today to try to get better, or to try to find a job, or to try to, you know, diversify your income streams? Because if you can't answer that question, well, I didn't go out to lunch today. Well, great, right? I don't think, you know, the $10 is going to move the needle much, but what did you do to try to bring in something? And I think once I figured that portion of it out, that anxiety or uncertainty started to dissipate because I actually was building towards something. And so if we liken it to our buddy with the rock up the hill, you know, despite not making it to the top, hey, you made it halfway, right? And if you look around, you built some muscles doing that. Now you can make it three quarters and then maybe you'll make it to the top. But you got to get on offense to start doing those things, or else it'll never happen.
Totally. Yeah, absolutely. I think hit a lot of points that people need to hear in terms of, you know, I think it's offense and life. Cause it's like, if you're on defense, then you're basically, you're going to take what life gives you. And like the whole point of being on offense is like making it happen. And Nisa and I, again, having a couple kiddos, you said it, reinvent. That's another, I think, key word that we've gone through is, you know, kind of lost our identity in who we were, which is okay. Like we're all supposed to grow. You should not be the same person, you know, today that you were last year, and you shouldn't be the same person next year that you were today. So it is like sometimes though, when a lot of stuff happens at the same time, you almost have that I've lost my identity and reinventing, and the moving forward is like the only way to do it. So lastly, as we wrap up, Mike, biggest pearl or suggestion for listeners right now? Like, what would be that one pearl? Like, do this if I could give you one thing.
Okay. So right now, what I see, and, you know, this is actually very, very relevant to even, you know, working with folks like Marina. We've tried to develop this group of what we call seed starters, right? And that's really for people who are interested in real estate investment, but really don't have the skills or know-how or experience to feel confident, especially in this marketplace, to make a move. And what I see is analysis paralysis, right? Is that they go into it asking all of these questions, which are typically buying signs, right? But they actually talk themselves out of the deal, right? And it's not to say that, hey, you know, you should be selective, it's your hard-earned money, all that kind of stuff. Absolutely. But if I could give people one suggestion, is that if you were to ask yourself the question this, not what if I do this, what if I don't, right? If you can simply answer that question and be okay with it, then you're on the right track. But if you ask yourself that question, what if I don't, and there it adds to your anxiety, or then I think you're on the path of being on defense right now. And so I think if in any situation that you're doing, whether it's taking a new job, pivoting your career path, starting with a new company, whatever that is, if you ask yourself, what if I don't do this? If the answer is, shit, I don't know, right? Like, this is scary. I think you have some kind of internal conversation that needs to happen to where you can kind of talk yourself through the pros and cons of either side of the equation. And I think you'll find that making a mistake or failing forward is actually a heck of a lot better than never taking a shot. So that would be my pearl of wisdom if I could give anybody.
Boom. The interesting thing about that is I had another like major investor out of the Springs in Colorado. And I think he runs like a $1 billion fund. I think that was his big one too, is pull the trigger, like run the numbers and then pull the trigger. So that's awesome. Sorry. It kind of froze there. Any last testaments, Mr. Michael Libertine?
No, great to be on the show. Thank you guys for listening up. If you guys have any questions, one of the things that I'm trying to channeling for 2024, and this is like you mentioned, this is the kind of raw, transparent belief system, is going, I really want to get behind the idea that other people succeeding is my success. I think so much in business, we really look at it like if someone's succeeding, I'm losing. So I'm adopting that abundance mindset shift. And so I would love to hear any of your guys' successes on how you did it, what made that secret sauce work for you, because it motivates and generates a fire in me, not to be competitive, but to be really jacked about other people's success. So that's my mantra for 2024. I'll do everything I can to do it. Love to hear your guys' stories.
Cool. Where can people find you?
Yeah. So I have my social handles. I'll send that over to you guys. We'll leave them in some sort of, but I work for Hawaii Mortgage Group. So michael.libertini@hmg.direct. And we'll get phone numbers and everything out for everybody to reach out.
Awesome, guys. Well, thank you, Mr. Michael Libertini, for being on the show. Thank you, listeners, for tuning in. Coffee is Foreclosures, as always. Look forward to next time.
Enjoyed this episode of Coffee for Closers? Subscribe to the show anywhere you find podcasts and follow Collab Agents on social @CollabAgents.